अन्याभिलाषिता शून्यम् ज्ञानकर्मादिनावृतम् आनुकूल्येन कृष्णानु शीलनं भक्तिरुत्तमा.
About something once the emphasis is lost, after a few days we'll forget that we're supposed to memorize, so might as well do it now. So please chant. Translation again. When first class devotional service develops, one must be devoid of all material desires. Knowledge obtained by monistic philosophy and fruitive action. The devotee must constantly serve Krishna favorably as Krishna desires. So I think most of you have these pages that were circulated in the last 2 days. If any of you have come late and you don't have it, you can just borrow it from someone and have it photocopied. So we'll continue the discussion, but before that we'll just revise a little bit of what we did, what we discussed yesterday. On the first day, we basically talked about the importance of this verse. We mentioned the two characteristics, the primary characteristics, the Swarup Lakshan, and the marginal characteristics, the Tatastha Lakshan. The Swarup Lakshan identifies the nature of ordinary bhakti, and the marginal characteristics, they qualify that ordinary bhakti. They add some special qualities to this ordinary bhakti to make it what? Pure bhakti or pure devotional service. So this definition, as we have seen, is very complete. It is precise. It is neither too limiting nor is it too extensive. Srila Rupa Goswami in his genius has precisely chosen every alphabet properly. So having discussed the primary characteristics on the first day, what are the primary characteristics? Who remembers? What's the line? Anukulyena Krishnanu Shilanam, which has three parts, which are Anukulyena Krishna Anushilanam. And we discussed how each of these words is important to make the subject of bhakti very, very clear. Then yesterday we focused on the first of the marginal characteristics, which is Anyabhilashita Shunyam. And this has how many parts? Nadita. Anya, Abhilashita, and Shunyam. So, who would like to explain in brief the significance of this Anya Abhilashita Shunyam? First of all, let's begin by asking a few questions. How do we define a material desire? What is a material desire? Yes. Any desire other than a desire to please Krishna and to serve Krishna, very correct, is material desire. Any desire to serve our own senses is material desire. And any desire to please Krishna, to serve Him favorably, is bhakti, leads us to prema. So then, what next did we discuss after that? What was the point? That if we take this as a definition, of pure devotional service, that one should not have any material desires, one should not at any point in time have any desires that are not exclusively meant for pleasing Krishna, then that is not pure devotional service. So, is this valid or is it not valid?
We added a qualification to it because it becomes very exclusive if we don't have the qualification. And the qualification that we added was the nature of desire. So, we have the
intention.
So, Anya Vilashita as opposed to Anya Vilasha.
Okay, if you make it Abhilasha, which means desire, it becomes too exclusive. And what is this implication of it being too exclusive? No, what is the implication? Okay, the definition is exclusive. So is there anything that's wrong with that? It excludes many, many pure devotees. It excludes practically all the pure devotees. Even the Brajabasis called out to Krishna in emergency. Kunti Maharani and her sons, the Pandavas, called out to Krishna. So everyone would be excluded from this definition. So therefore, Rupa Goswami has not used the word Anya Abhilasha, which means other desire. Rather, he has used the word Abhilashita. What is the meaning of Abhilashita as opposed to Abhilasha?
Nature.
The nature. The nature of what?
Desire.
Desiring what? The nature of desiring something other than that which is meant for pleasing Krishna. That Abhilasha, Anya Abhilasha, other desire, the nature of desiring something Anya, something different from what is meant for Krishna's pleasure exclusively. So one may incidentally have, as a result of some emergency, dire situation connected to self-preservation, some desire that may not be meant exclusively for pleasing Krishna, but if one doesn't have the nature of always desiring something separate from Krishna, if it is contrary to one's devotional nature, then such emergency desires meant for one's preservation, one's survival and so on, are not to be considered a fault on one's bhakti. It's not to be considered a blemish. It does not go against the principle of pure devotional service. Right? So who would like to explain this? You know, the best way to understand something is to teach it. The best way to test yourself if you really understood something is to speak it out. So the example of Draupadi was given, that's right, that she called out to Krishna to save her honor, but it was not her nature to ask for things that are not for Krishna's pleasure. It was not her nature. Her nature was to always serve Krishna. Draupadi was a pure devotee of Krishna. She always desired to serve Krishna favorably, 24 hours a day. But by Krishna's own arrangement, the Pandavas were put into such dire straits that practically every day, that they were forced to take shelter of Krishna. So Draupadi's calling out for Krishna is still within the realm of pure devotional service, although, technically speaking, strictly speaking, from the point of view of this world, saving one's honor for a lady, however grave the issue may be, is still something material. It's not connected to the soul. It's still connected to the body. But because the overall nature of Draupadi is that she is a completely surrendered, pure devotee of Krishna, therefore such desires in an emergency situation do not go contrary to the principle of pure devotional service. So this is why we have the difference between an Abhilasha and Abhilashita. So one should not have the date of the desire, the nature of petitioning Krishna again and again for something that is not meant for his service or for his pleasure. That is the point. So when Rupa Goswami says Anya Abhilashita Shunyam, the Shunyam or the zero is not meant for the Abhilasha, the desire, is meant for the Anya. It's not that Rupa Goswami says the desires must be zero. No. Desires cannot be zero because the spirit soul is not dead. The spirit soul is always conscious. A conscious living entity always has thoughts, has desires. You cannot artificially negate thoughts as the Mayavadis want to do. The Mayavadis, they try to become thoughtless and then they realize that they're becoming thoughtless. That's a contradiction in itself, isn't it? Then you're thinking that I am thoughtless. So it doesn't make sense. One cannot be thoughtless. But there will be thoughts, there will be desires. But those desires must be favorably directed towards pleasing Krishna and serving Him. That's the point. So in this way, we talked about the first marginal characteristic of bhakti, that we should become free from the propensity to ask Krishna for things that are material or things that are not connected to his service or pleasure. Now, yesterday I think there were some questions at the end and then we could not finish it because the arati began. So for a few minutes, if there were any questions pertaining to yesterday's discussion, we'll continue. Yesterday there was one question about preaching, that if we encounter a person, we are preaching to that person, and that person has many material desires or is in some difficulty and is not in a position to listen to any philosophy about pure devotion. So should we tell that person about the highest principle of pure devotion, or should we say that, well, come to Krishna and your desires will be fulfilled? That was one question yesterday, wasn't it? So I had given the example of Narad Muni preaching to Dhruva Maharaj. And when he saw that Dhruva Maharaj was not in a position to listen to any higher instruction, then he satisfied him and said, all right, you want a kingdom? Here, chant this mantra, go ahead. But because he contacted Krishna, his material desires were purified. So I'd like to add one or two sentences to this, that initially we should judge the person we are preaching to. If that person is receptive to the principle of pure devotional service, we should certainly say that. Even if the person is not in a position to listen or accept it, we can say it and then say, well, that's the standard. But even then, just come to Krishna, doesn't matter. Even if you're not able to come up to the standard, just come and chant Hare Krishna. Also, when we talk of highest devotional standards, we should know that all the time we preach about going back to Godhead, getting out of this material world and going back to Godhead. Isn't that what we talk about all the time? So is that pure devotional service? What do you think? Going back to Godhead is pure devotional service or not? Think. Depends on the intention. Please elaborate.
Or if someone wants to go just because he suffers so much that he can't bear it anymore, He wants to find a pleasurable, comfortable situation, then it's wrong. But if he wants to go back and join Krishna's eternal pastime, then it could be more fluid.
Very nice. Excellent. If our desire to go back to Godhead is based on the fact that I don't want to pay my taxes anymore, I don't want to go to hospital anymore, I don't want to get hungry anymore, I want to be relieved of the suffering of this world and I want to enjoy happily forever, then that desire to go back to Godhead is mixed with our own personal motivation. I want to be free from suffering. It's not Krishna. It's got nothing to do with Krishna. Krishna is incidental. Because I can be in that situation only with Krishna, so then I'm bringing Krishna into my program of life. But otherwise, my goal is I want to be free from suffering. Well, to start with, that's good. At least we're starting with that understanding, so people understand that this world is a place of suffering. So when we preach, and even at an everyday level in our discussions, even in Srimad Bhagavatam class, we may talk about this, no problem. But yet, we should understand the higher principle. There was Vasudev Datta. He was such a great devotee of the Lord. He agreed to take on the sins of all the living entities in the universe, even if it meant that the enormous burden of the sin would keep him in hell forever. Vasudev Datta happily agreed to the idea. In fact, he offered it. And his point was that if all the other living entities in the universe can be benefited by eternal life, and the price for that is that one worthless soul like me has to be in hell, it's an insignificant price to pay. So I'm very happily willing for that. Also, the principle of bhakti at a higher level is that we do not even seek liberation. Krishna will give it. Or Krishna may not give it also. But we are not concerned. Our concern is not these forms of liberation. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, in the third canto, Kapiladev explains, Ahaituki avyavahita sa bhaktihi purushottame salokya sarshti samipya sarupya ekatvam ati uta diyamanam na grihananti vina matsevanam janaha. The meaning of this verse is, bhakti towards Purushottam or Lord Krishna has to be ahituki and avyavahita. Ahituki means without any material motivation, that is anyabhilashita shunyam. And avyavahita means it should be without cessation, without interruption. That means jnana karmadyanavritam, which is a second characteristic which we're going to talk about shortly. And then he says, there are five kinds of liberation. Who knows the five kinds of liberation? Anyone? I mention it in this verse that I quoted. First, salokya. What's the meaning of salokya? Loka means planet. Salokya means that we get the liberation and stay on the same planet as the Lord in the spiritual world. Second, sarupya. Rup means form. So we get a form similar to the Lord's. Third, sarshti. What does it mean? To get the kind of opulences and powers as the Lord. Fourth, samipya. What does that mean? To be very close to the Lord, to be one of the Lord's associates. Not just to stay on the same planet, but to be in his inner circle. Very, very close to the Lord. And what's the fifth one? Sayujya or ekatva. What is that? Merging into the impersonal Brahman. The impersonal effulgence of Lord Krishna. The fifth one, the devotees never want, certainly. But even the first four ones, Kapiladev says, diyamanam na grihananti vina matsevanam janaha. Kapiladev says that if I give these five kinds of liberation to my devotees, even if I give it, they don't accept it. If there is no opportunity for service to the Lord, to me, Kapiladev says. In other words, we don't even want to go back to Godhead if there's no chance of doing service over there. Of course, going back to Godhead, we will do service, but the point is that it is service that is important. It is a desire to please Krishna that is important. It's not going back to Godhead that is important. Therefore, what has Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said in the Shikshashtakam? Who remembers? Na dhanam na janam na sundarim kavitam vacha gadish kamaye mama janmani janmanishvare bhavatat bhaktir ahaituki tvai. This is anyabhilashita shunyam. He says, I don't want wealth, I don't want beautiful women, I don't want followers, I don't want even liberation from material existence. Birth after birth, I simply want your uninterrupted, unmotivated devotional service. That's all I want. So this is pure devotional service. So Mahaprabhu here has also indicated that we don't want even liberation. Even Vaishnava liberation, we are not so much concerned with. So therefore, we are talking of three platforms now. The first platform is the highest platform. We are not concerned with liberation. We are only concerned with purely trying to serve Krishna and trying to please Him. It doesn't matter where we are, in hell, on earth, in London, or in Vrindavan, or in Goloka Vrindavan. It doesn't matter. We simply want to serve as per His desire. Slightly lower is, well, let's get out of this material world and go back to Goloka and live eternally with Krishna. That's also an acceptable platform. And a slightly lower platform is, doesn't matter if you have material desires, but come to Krishna. Worship Krishna. Krishna will purify you. So like that, there are different platforms at which we can understand these things. So in any case, this is how we see the principle. We have such a lofty principle, such a sublime, high ideal. But we shouldn't become disheartened thinking, oh, it's too high for me, might as well give it up. You know, there was a... You all heard the Trinadapi Shunichena Shloka, isn't it? Trinadapi sunichena tarorapi sahishnuna amanina manadena kirtaniya sadahari. Where Mahaprabhu says that one must become humbler than a blade of grass, more tolerant than a tree, be willing to offer respect to others and not expecting any respect for oneself. And at one time, there is a little Bengali verse about this. There was a poet who wanted to know what is a Vaishnava. So he came. And he said, Vaishnav ho ar mone chilo shad, trinadapi shlok shune pode galo bad. He said, I have a long time nurtured the desire to want to be a Vaishnav. But when I heard this trinadapi shloka, I said, forget it. It's not for me. Humbler than a blade of grass, more tolerant than a tree, what next? Offer all respect to others. Sorry. Can't do all this. So like that, we shouldn't think, oh, anyabhilashita shunya, my God, that's too much. And this, I think, might as well forget. No. We should just continue on. And devotees actually make more advancement than they think. Many times devotees say, you know, I've been chanting Hare Krishna for so long, but I am where I was 15 years ago. No, we are not. We are making advancement. But because we are so close to ourselves, so we don't realize it. Everybody else notices how a child is growing except the child. Others see the child. The child is not seeing himself, so he doesn't know how he's growing. So we are making progress. And of course, a sincere devotee always tries to prosecute Krishna consciousness very, very nicely, sincerely. So that's the point. Any other questions before we go on to the other marginal characteristic pertaining to yesterday? Yesterday's discussion, yes. The question is that when we read Krishna book, we get pleasure. So we're reading for our pleasure. So is that pure devotional service? You see, it's not a crime in devotional service to be happy. It's natural. It's a natural consequence of being Krishna conscious. Such is the nature of devotional service that when you read Krishna book, you feel happy. And we read it because Prabhupada has told us, you must read every day my books. My only complaint, Prabhupada said, is my devotees don't read my books. So we are reading it because Prabhupada wants us to read it. We are reading these books because Krishna wants us to read it. Krishna wants us to always hear about Him, talk about Him, remember Him. So because we are following obediently, we get the mercy, we get that pleasure. There are many people who read these things, but they don't experience the joy. There are mundane scholars who try to analyze the Srimad Bhagavatam in so many ways. But they are mundane scholars. Their motivation for reading is different. So certainly, if you feel pleasure in reading Krishna book, go ahead, read more. It's certainly pure devotional service. But if there's some important service coming up, sorry, I'm reading Krishna book, I can't come. No, that shouldn't be. If there's some urgent service that comes up, then we must be willing to sacrifice our little pleasure for another service which may be more pleasing to Krishna. Although both is devotional service. Both are devotional service, but we have to judge what's more important at a given point in time and then do it accordingly. But yes, as a regular routine, it is very important for devotees to study Srila Prabhupada's books every day. This will give us the higher taste. It will give strength to our mind and keep us strong and convinced on this path. Side by side, we should do our sadhana also very nicely. Yes.
Swami, you were mentioning about Vasudeva Tattva.
Yes.
How he accomplished level 106 for him to conduct the hell for the rest of his life.
Yes.
I was arguing with someone else one day, and do you really think he was arguing that that is not charity because he gains pleasure by actually taking on other people's sins? So he's not. He may not be helping others, but he is actually doing it for his pleasure. And he was explaining about the concept of pleasure, you know, the pleasure concept. So I'm a bit confused.
Vasudev Datta did not do that for his own pleasure. He did it out of his overwhelming compassion. When he saw the intense suffering of the living entities conditioned in this material world, that offer came from that compassion. Well, it is natural. It's not that, as I was mentioning earlier, it's not wrong to feel happy. It's the nature of the soul to be happy, after all. But because we are seeking happiness in the wrong things, therefore we are suffering. So we see, actually, it's a fact that when you try to serve, you get more happiness than when you receive service. So therefore, Vasudev Datta's offer stemmed from a very deep compassion in his heart. Yes, Madhu.
I was thinking that the same duty for our poor will be pleasing Krishna, and that's the certain Krishna. But when we are not in the situation with the associating with the devotee or on a situation or work situation, when we are not a sort of, you know, associated with the people who are not Krishna conscious. What is the situation? I mean, we're not talking about Krishna. This is a different situation. So it's not pleasing to Krishna.
The question is that when we are in the association of non-devotees, then we're not talking about Krishna and the situation is not pleasing to Krishna. Well, Rupa Goswami has advised us that we should try to maximize our association with devotees and minimize our association with non-devotees. Now, a certain degree of association with non-devotees is inevitable in this world for the sake of survival. You have to earn your livelihood or for some other practical reason, or for even for preaching's sake. When our devotees go out on the streets to distribute books, they're interacting with non-devotees. So we have to do certain things in life that are inevitable. So what we should do is to keep ourselves spiritually very strong by following Srila Prabhupada's program of hearing and chanting and so on. And then we will be able to protect ourselves rather from the bad influence of the association of non-devotees. So what we'll do now is we'll go on to the next, second marginal characteristic, which is jnana karma adi anavritam. Jnana karma adi anavritam. The first characteristic was that one's devotional service should be free from these material desires or the propensity to want to ask Krishna for something that's not for his service. And the second is that bhakti should not be covered over by jnana, karma, etc. The word avaran in Sanskrit means a covering or a curtain. Avrit means to be covered over. Anavrit means to be not covered by. So the word anavritam is that it should not be covered by. By what? Jnana, karma, adi. By three things. Jnana in general means knowledge. But here we are not talking of ordinary knowledge. We are not talking of knowledge that pertains to Krishna, his beautiful form, his name, his qualities, his pastimes, his fame, his abode and so on. The kind of knowledge that leads us to bhakti, that leads us to love Krishna, that knowledge is required. But that kind of knowledge, that kind of philosophical speculation that leads us to a conclusion that everything is zero, voidism, or to the conclusion that the Lord is impersonal, he is just some light, God is not a person. That kind of philosophical speculation, that process of acquiring knowledge is what is harmful to our bhakti, that covers over our bhakti. Now there is this kind of religious processes or philosophies that advocate paths like this have become very fashionable. For example, Buddhism has become very fashionable now. From Hollywood stars to everyone wants to follow Buddhism. It's very convenient because it sounds non-sectarian. It sounds so vague that anyone can do. It's practically not like a religion. You're talking of some void. You're talking of some new age concept, some reincarnation and something thrown in together. So Buddhism is actually an atheistic religion. It's not actually religion also. It's voidism, shunyavad. They say there is no reality, nothing exists. So any philosophical process that leads us to that conclusion may seem fashionable today, but it definitely is detrimental to our bhakti. Similarly, if people want to accept some ultimate reality, then they may follow the Mayavad process of Shankaracharya. That's also something that's fashionable because you don't have to have any particular God. It's all impersonal. It's all light. It's all vague. Anyone can believe it. So any sort of philosophical speculation that leads us to that conclusion covers over our bhakti. Bahunam janmanam ante jnanavan mam prapadyate vasudevah sarvamiti sa mahatma sudurlabhah. Krishna says that if after cultivating real knowledge for many lifetimes, one comes to the conclusion that Vasudev or Sri Krishna is the all-in-all and one surrenders to him and becomes his devotee, then that kind of process of knowledge is perfect. But if it leads us to the conclusion that everything is impersonal, then that covers over the bhakti. There is one devotee in ISKCON. He's a very senior devotee actually. Several years ago, at least 6 or 7 years ago, maybe more. Yeah, 5 years ago. I was having a chat with him and he was revealing his mind. And he was saying that before he became a devotee, he joined ISKCON, he was going to some Mayavadi spiritual organization where they were teaching that the absolute truth is impersonal. It's just some light. And he was frequenting that place and trying to absorb that philosophy and that whole process of logic and the reasoning, the philosophy. And he says, now I've been 25 years in ISKCON. I'm chanting 16 rounds every day. I give class on the Bhagavatam and the Bhagavad Gita. I am preaching. I am doing everything. But sometimes I'm haunted by the idea, is God really personal? Can God really be a person? Philosophically, logically, sometimes a thought comes out to haunt him again because he's so accustomed to the idea from his early days that the Absolute Truth cannot be a person. It has to be impersonal. And the logic, that logic sometimes shakes up his conviction. Maybe not in a serious way, but it does certainly cause some agitation in mind. It's so dangerous. Listening to this kind of philosophical reasoning can be very, very detrimental. Therefore, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has warned, Mayavadi bhashushunale hoy sarvanash. If one hears the Mayavad philosophy, then certainly one is doomed. There is a story which is told both in the Chaitanya Bhagavat and also the Chaitanya Charitamrita about Mukunda, the associate of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who was also a very beautiful singer. Mahaprabhu used to love to listen to him singing. It was just simply nectarian. When Mahaprabhu had his Mahaprakash Leela, when he was offering all kinds of benedictions to his devotees, he didn't deliberately call Mukunda. He called everyone and fulfilled all their desires. But Mukunda didn't come forward on his own, and neither did Mahaprabhu call him up. After some time, after a lot of time had elapsed, Srivas Thakur went up to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and says, my dear Lord, what has Mukunda done? What is his offense? He is your life and soul, so why have you not called him up? So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, don't even mention his name to me. On one hand, he comes in front of me with straw in his teeth, making a show of humility and agreeing to all the devotional conclusions of the Vaishnavas, singing kirtan and everything. And then afterwards, he comes and beats me with an iron rod. So Srivas Thakur said, my dear Lord, you know Mukunda, we know Mukunda. We do not see any offense on Mukunda's part. What is it that he has done that merits you taking such a harsh stand about him? So Mahaprabhu said, you see, this Mukunda, he goes to assemblies where the Yoga Vasishtha scripture or the book is discussed. Now the Yoga Vasishtha is a book that expounds Mayavadi conclusions. It essentially talks about how it concludes the philosophy or the line of reasoning and logic there comes to the conclusion that the Absolute is impersonal. So this Mukunda goes and listens to discourses that eventually lead to the point of impersonalism, and he agrees with everything. Then he comes here to the devotees, and when we speak about Krishna, he agrees to everything. So anyone who believes that there is any process superior to devotional service or bhakti is beating me with an iron rod. So therefore, I will not call Mukunda. So Mukunda was very sorry to hear this. And then he said, all right, if this is the way the Lord wants to shower his mercy on me. So he told Srivas Thakur, please ask the Lord, how long will it be before he will grant me his darshan, his audience again? So Srivas Thakur asked Mahaprabhu. And Mahaprabhu said, tell Mukunda that for 10 million births I will not give him darshan. He will have to wait for 10 million births. So when Srivas Thakur told this to Mukunda, when he heard this, Mukunda started jumping and dancing in ecstasy. Only 10 million births, only 10 million births. So Mukunda's point was that I have to wait 10 million births, doesn't matter, but at least after that, the mercy of the Lord and the darshan of the Lord is assured. It's certain because the Lord has said it himself. So in any case, this is a wonderful pastime. Mahaprabhu, of course, called him and embraced him after he heard that. and said, Mukunda, you are my eternal associate. How can I ever be angry with you? Your sweet singing melts everybody's hearts. I actually manifest on your tongue when you sing. So please stay here. Another instance comes to mind is Advaita Acharya himself. You see, Advaita Acharya always felt embarrassed that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu treated him like a guru. Advaita Acharya was about 50 years older than Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And he was like a guru and a father. But nevertheless, Advaita Acharya wanted Mahaprabhu to treat him like a servant, to treat him like his disciple and follower, which Mahaprabhu would not do. He would always treat Advaita Acharya with too much respect. And Advaita Acharya was very, very uncomfortable with this. And he was hatching all kinds of plans to make Chaitanya Mahaprabhu treat him like a servant. Somehow he wanted Mahaprabhu to chastise him. Because only a master chastises a servant. So what could he do that would make Mahaprabhu really reprimand him? So he was thinking, then he said, yes. If I start expounding Yoga Vasishtha impersonal philosophy and start speaking on that logical, the line of reasoning that brings us to the point that the Lord is impersonal, then Mahaprabhu will be so angry with me that he will chastise me. And then he went around everywhere talking about impersonal philosophy. Haridas Thakur laughed because he knew what was in Advaita Acharya's mind. He didn't take him seriously. But one time, Mahaprabhu heard that Advaita Acharya is going around talking impersonal philosophy and giving people a line of reasoning like this. So Mahaprabhu took Haridas Thakur and said, I'm going to teach this Acharya a lesson. From Navadvip he came to Shantipur and he came to Advaita Acharya's house. And he said, so Acharya, please tell me, which is superior, the path of bhakti or the path of jnana? And Acharya replied immediately without hesitation, of course the path of jnana. The Lord is ultimately impersonal. And then he started giving all kinds of logic. And then Mahaprabhu couldn't tolerate it. So he pulled Advaita Acharya out into the courtyard and started beating him. And then Advaita Acharya's wife started becoming nervous. Even Haridas Thakur was a little fearfully chanting Krishna, Krishna, Krishna. And his wife was saying, my Lord, what are you doing? He's an old Brahmana. He may die. And then you will repent that you killed an old Brahmana. Then Mahaprabhu stopped. And then he felt very ashamed. And Advaita Acharya was jubilant. Now his perfection of life was attained. Mahaprabhu had chastised him, which means that he accepted him as a servant. In any case, the point is that such logic is so harmful to bhakti. It completely covers bhakti, and as Mahaprabhu said, it's like striking the Lord with an iron rod. Tapan Mishra's son, Raghunath Bhatt Goswami, lived in Varanasi. Tapan Mishra, on the instruction of Mahaprabhu, moved from Bangladesh to Varanasi, Kashi. And at a certain point in time, he left home and he went to Jagannath Puri to meet Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Along the way, he met one devotee, or he met a person whose name was Ramdas Vishwas. He met him in Bengal. And this man was belonged to the Kayastha community. And he was very learned in some scriptures. And he was very humble. Because Raghunath Bhatta was a Brahmana. So then he served Raghunath Bhatta very menially. He carried his luggage on his head. And when they rested for the night, he would actually massage his legs. And all the time he would just chant Lord Ramachandra's names. So Raghunath Bhatta was very, very uncomfortable with this, and he pleaded with this man not to serve him. But that man insisted. He said, you're a Brahmana, I am a Kayastha, it's my duty to serve you. In any case, they reached Jagannath Puri and they came in front of Mahaprabhu. Mahaprabhu was overjoyed to see Raghunath Bhatta. He had been expecting him. And he embraced him and asked about the welfare of the devotees in Kashi. particularly Chandrasekhar Acharya, Tapan Mishra and so on. But he completely ignored this man Ramdas Vishwas. He just saw through him. He dealt with him as if he never saw him, as if he didn't exist. He just ignored him. So later Raghunath Bhatta asked Mahaprabhu about this. And Mahaprabhu informed him that actually this Ramdas Vishwas is an impersonalist. In his mind, he thinks that the Absolute is impersonal. His conception of Ram is also that the impersonal has assumed the form of Ram. So therefore, he is an offender. He shows that he is a devotee, but actually he is not a devotee. Because the conclusion, the philosophy that he believes in is something very, very contrary to the principles of pure devotional service. So there are numerous stories like this. So the point is that Rupa Goswami is saying that this jnana, the path of jnana, that process of logic or reasoning or knowledge that leads us to conclude that the Absolute is void or impersonal, covers over our bhakti and therefore must be rejected. Similarly, karma. Jnana, karma, adi. Karma here refers to not ordinary activity. It doesn't refer also to activities which are Krishnanushilanam, which are activities meant for the service of the Lord. We are doing so many activities in Krishna consciousness, but not that kind of karma. The karma referred to here is karma kanda, specifically the ritualistic activities that are offered in the Vedas. There are some daily duties, some periodic duties. Those of you who are familiar, you know that many times Hindus, they have all these rituals they perform. On Tuesday, they go to such and such demigod temple. Or if they have some difficulty in life, they go to some astrologer. And the astrologer tells them that, well, such and such demigoddess or demigod can relieve you. So you wear this particular ring and you chant the mantra of that particular demigod and offer some oblations, do some sacrifice to please that demigod. And then you will be free. So this kind of ritualistic naimittika duties, occasional duties which we do, are also not conducive to the development of our bhakti. Because it contradicts the principle of pure devotional service. And even if we do have some major issue which we want solved, we should rather go to Krishna. Why should we go to the demigods? Is it that the demigods are more capable than Krishna? Are the demigods able to give more than what Krishna can give? So why do we have less faith in Krishna? Why do we approach anyone other than Krishna for even something material? There is no need. Krishna is full and complete in himself. In fact, the ability of the demigods to grant benedictions to their worshippers is also given by Krishna. So this process of karma or fruitive activities also covers over our bhakti. One has to be cautious. We may use astrology and all these things as tools, no problem. But we mustn't get so carried away that we become ritualistic to the extent that we lose our faith in Krishna and Krishna consciousness. And we start considering these things to be more important. At Naimisharanya, Suta Goswami spoke the Srimad Bhagavatam to the sages who had assembled there. These sages had been performing some ritualistic, fruitive activities and sacrifices at Naimisharanya. However, Suta Goswami was not interested in these ritualistic ceremonies. He was only interested in repeating what Shukadev Goswami had said. He was only interested in talking about Krishna and his pastimes. And as he went on narrating those pastimes, these sages at Naimisharanya were so happy that they said, Karmanyasvina nashvase dhuma dhumratmanam bhavan apayati govinda pad padmasavam madhu. They said, "My dear Suta Goswami, before you came, we were all assembled here, and for many years we have performed all these ritualistic sacrifices with the fire, with the sacred fire. And they were kind of fruitive activities. But we find Anashwas say that they haven't yielded their fruit. The fruit of these sacrifices is uncertain, and the only certain result that we have obtained from this is that our faces have become black from the smoke that has come from the fire. Dhuma dhumaratmanam bhavan." And therefore now we are completely satisfied with drinking, that you have made us drink rather. Apayayati. What have you made us drink? Pad padma asavam madhu. Madhu means sweet. Pad padma means lotus feet. Asav means the beverage, very nectarian beverage. Of whom? Govinda, Krishna. Govinda pad padmasavam madhu. So now that you have made us drink the nectarian beverage, which is very sweet, of the lotus feet of Lord Krishna, now we are not interested anymore in these fruitive activities. So when we get entangled in karmic activities, karmakandic activities, that also conceals our bhakti. Then Rupa Goswami says, Gyan karma adi. The word adi in Sanskrit means etc. So it refers to other processes like Sankhya Yoga, renunciation, or Hatha Yoga, and so on. Renunciation is necessary in spiritual life. So even in the path of devotion, we do follow some principles of renunciation. What are the principles of renunciation we follow? Can you give some examples? Any examples? No, some examples of the renunciation that we follow as devotees.
We don't take intoxication.
Yes, we follow the four regulative principles. That's renunciation. We're avoiding illicit sex, intoxication, meat eating, and gambling. That's renunciation. We renounce so many things in life. We renounce mundane cinema or mundane TV. We renounce so many things. We renounce eating any food that is not offered to Krishna. So there are principles of renunciation here. It is necessary for bhakti. But at the same time, if we focus too much on the renunciation, then that can distract us from the principle of pure bhakti, because we get caught up in renunciation. Bhakti is not only renunciation. Renunciation comes when we serve Krishna. In the Chaitanya Bhagavad, there's another story of the kirtans that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would have with his devotees in Navadvipa. They would chant in Srivas Thakur's house, even sometimes all through the night, and they would lock up all the doors so that no outsider could enter. No unqualified person had access to these kirtans, which were very confidential. Only the intimate devotees of Mahaprabhu were allowed inside. Many, many people wanted to come inside, but they were not allowed to. One time there was a brahmachari who had come. This brahmachari was belonged to some other sampradaya. He was just a very, very renounced person. And he lived only on milk and fruits. He would never eat grains. And he lived a very austere and simple life. And he pleaded with Srivas Thakur that, "Please, let me witness this sankirtan of all you pandits. Let me be there, because I'm a sinless person." After a lot of persuasion, Srivas Thakur finally agreed. He said, "Yes, actually you're a sinless person. You're a good man. So I'll hide you in. But you remain concealed here. Don't come out, because Mahaprabhu doesn't want outsiders. But because you're a sinless person, you're not envious, therefore I will take you in." So Srivas Thakur allowed this person to come in, and he remained concealed. And the kirtan started. Mahaprabhu got completely absorbed in the tumultuous kirtan. But after a while, Mahaprabhu stopped And he said, there's something wrong here. Is there someone here in this room who shouldn't be here? Srivas Thakur started trembling. Yes, my lord, actually there is someone. But you see, he's sinless. He's a very austere brahmachari. In fact, he lives only on milk and fruit. Then Mahaprabhu became angry. He said, do you think that you can obtain me by drinking milk and fruit? Is that the process to obtain me? What sadhana has this brahmachari done that he should obtain me? It is not by drinking milk and fruit alone that you can obtain me. Of course, Mahaprabhu was not criticizing milk drinking. We should drink milk, cow's milk, we should drink. But Mahaprabhu was making a point that simply by living an austere life, you cannot get Krishna. You cannot reach spiritual perfection. And he said, he may be a brahmana, he may be very austere, but because he has not surrendered to me, therefore he is not eligible to come here into these kirtans. On the other hand, if there is someone who is born in the family of dog eaters, if that person surrenders to me, then I give him my mercy. What austerities did Hanuman do? What austerities did Gajendra the elephant do? What austerities did the milkmaids of Vrindavan, who were simple village girls, do? But still, they got my favor. As opposed to that, there were so many powerful demons who performed tremendous austerities, very difficult for others to do. And what was the result? They became a menace to the whole universe, and I had to kill them. So therefore, it is not just by austerities or renunciation that one can obtain the Supreme Lord. When the brahmachari heard this, he felt very ashamed. And then he slipped out, and in his mind he was thinking, I'm so fortunate that I at least got some darshan of the Lord and the devotees doing kirtan, and I'm completely unqualified. And feeling humble within his heart, he was going away. Mahaprabhu, of course, is Krishna, so he understood what was in this devotee's heart, this man's heart. So he called him back and placed his lotus feet on that brahmachari's head and said, don't think that you can get me by austerities and renunciation. Do not try to become powerful by your renunciation and austerities. Try to become a servant of the devotees. Surrender and all perfection shall be achieved. In other words, we can learn from the story that when we try to become too renounced, too austere, that's also not good. In the 11th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, Lord Krishna explains to Uddhava that if one has no renunciation, no austerities, one is qualified for the path of sense enjoyment. If one is up for the path of karma, that means fruitive work, enjoyment. If one is too renounced, too austere, then one is qualified for the path of jnana. For the path of jnana that leads to the impersonalist conclusion. But the devotee, Krishna says, is in between. He is neither too averse to the material world, neither too renounced, nor is he too attached to the material world. So the devotee follows a middle path, neither too attached nor too renounced. So our program is, we follow the principle of regulated, balanced renunciation, balanced austerities, as our acharyas have taught us. Srila Prabhupada has given us a program, a complete program of balanced renunciation and austerities. And we follow that because it's a help for our devotional practices. Four regulative principles are not an issue in and of themselves. Do you think in Goloka Vrindavan four regulative principles are an issue? Does it matter in Goloka Vrindavan? There's no such issue. In the material world, it's a big thing. Four regulative principles. So these are only meant to help us to chant better, to hear better, to serve Krishna better. That's all. In and of themselves, these activities are not bhakti. They are only meant to assist our bhakti. Therefore, if we focus too much on these things, then they will cover our bhakti. So therefore, Rupa Goswami says, Jnana Karma Adi Anavritam. The second characteristic of pure bhakti is, the marginal characteristic is that the bhakti should not be covered over by philosophical speculation, by ritualistic fruitive activities, and by other processes like Sankhya, Yoga, Jnana and so on, renunciation and so on. That is the qualification for one to develop Uttama Bhakti, or first class bhakti as Prabhupada calls it, pure devotional service. Any questions or comments? Yes.
There's a question which is more related to the first session that we had. How do you classify when someone performs unknowingly devotional service, get to Sukriti, how is that classified? Because it brings one closer to Krishna. Is it devotional service or not?
It's a good question. Devotional service performed unknowingly, is it in the realm of pure devotional service or not? Right? That's the question. It is called Sukriti. Sukriti means a devotional credit. That devotional credit ultimately brings one to the point where we consciously, willingly, knowingly render devotional service. It takes lifetimes of accumulation of these pious credits, devotionally pious credits. Gyat or agyat, knowingly or unknowingly performed, these devotional credits accumulate, and in one particular life, and for all of us it's in this one life, it accumulates, the bank balance of devotional credits has sufficiently accumulated that now we like to consciously perform devotional service. So it is devotional service, but at the same time, because it is not done with an intention to please Krishna, it's not quite in the category of pure devotional service. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, a pot in which there is butter and yogurt also offers service to Krishna. Pot is not hostile to Krishna. The pot is offering some service to Krishna, but the pot is not rendering bhakti. So similarly, if it is unknowingly done, it's service, but it's not quite in the category of pure devotional service yet, because that element of anukulyena is not there. However, it is important, because it is by the accumulation of such credits that eventually one comes to the point of association of devotees. One hears, and then one realizes, oh, I must serve Krishna favorably. Okay? Yes.
The story quite...
We can go on beyond 9 o'clock, isn't it?
Yes.
If the arati is going on, we can do that, discuss. Okay.
It's a story, a well-known story, which is told to illustrate the power of service to Krishna. There's the example of the...
Mouse, yes.
Who fanned the... So, how is it that... That's an exceptional case, I suppose.
Yes, the incident you're referring to is this mouse was on the altar and there was a wick that was about to get extinguished, and the mouse thought it was some food, tried to get it, but the whiskers disturbed them, got burnt, and the rat shook the wick, so it again started burning. So for having done the service of relighting the lamp in front of Krishna, he got a human birth. And then he was able to come to Krishna consciousness. So that's the same point. It's Agyata Sukriti. It's an accumulation of devotional credits that brings us to the point of actually doing that nicely. Just like in some airlines, you accumulate these flying credits And when you have sufficiently accumulated them, then you can fly free. So it's important you accumulate. But now we have come here, we want to willingly render service to please Krishna. Yes? Monistic comes from the word monism. Monism means oneness. Everything is one. The impersonal Brahman. So monistic philosophy means that philosophy which brings us to the point that there is only one reality that's impersonal, that is the Brahman. Is somebody else had raised their hand here? Yes.
One has, according to the definition of devotional service, one has a desire, motivation, repeatedly wishing to serve, and is following what is in their hearts to be that desire to try and please Krishna. Yet, in the circle of you know, Gaudiya Vaishnavism, we hear that pleasing devotees is perhaps higher goal than to please Krishna. And there is a misconception of that service, and there's criticism amongst the devotees, which is important. What's in their heart is Krishna, but to adjust that to the criticism of the devotees.
The question is, which is more important, pleasing Krishna or pleasing Krishna's devotees? Right? Is that this?
I mean, if what's in one's heart is to please Krishna, yet it's misconceived. And there is, you know, the devotees feel it's not service. What should they do? We should follow what's in their heart, please Krishna, or follow what devotees are saying?
Both. Ultimately, how do we know what Krishna is saying? From Guru Sadhu Shastra. Shri Shri Radha Gokulananda ki jai, Shri Shri Gaur Nitai ki jai, Shri Shri Sita Ram Lakshman Hanuman ki jai. So shall we continue or? We'll continue, okay. So certainly devotional service or service to Krishna is not separate from service to the devotees. When we defined bhakti or devotional service earlier, in the word Krishnanushilanam, the word Krishna included, if you remember, the Vaishnavas or the devotees. So therefore, there is no contradiction. One serves the devotees because it pleases Krishna, one serves Krishna and it pleases the devotees. So both are necessary. Any other questions? Yes.
Some people are, by their tendencies, they are much more attracted towards the impersonal model. When we do preaching, so by their argument itself. So is there, I mean, they have done that some sinful activity in the terms of karma, or they have done towards the Lord, or it is just only bad association? What is the reason?
The question is, there are some people whom we meet in the course of our preaching who have a natural inclination towards the impersonal realization. So what is the reason for that? You see, there are different kinds of credits that we accumulate in many lives which lead us to develop a certain mentality. The devotional credits that we talked about, that kind of sukriti is called Bhakti Unmukhi Sukriti. Those credits that build up devotional credits for us, that bring us to bhakti. Like the example of the mouse relighting the lamp on the altar. Or for example, our devotees go out for Harinam Sankirtan on the streets. An ignorant passerby just hears Hare Krishna mantra. He doesn't know anything. He takes some prasadam from them. He doesn't know the value of this prasadam, but he thinks it's a nice sweet, he eats it. He hears the holy name, he thinks it's nice music. So he's hearing. He doesn't know the significance or the implication of that. But he's accumulating these pious credits, which are of a devotional nature. And they will one time bring him to the point of consciously rendering service to Krishna. Similarly, there is also something called Jnana Unmukhi Sukriti. By associating with those who are on the path of Jnana, one develops this credit. So that mentality also develops appropriately, where one develops a natural inclination towards the impersonal, one veers towards that. And then again there's Bhoga Unmukhi Sukriti, that is normal piety, planting trees, giving charity to the poor, healing the sick and so on. So that gives you facility for material enjoyment, for sense pleasure, or for living a pious, happy life. So people who have a natural inclination towards the impersonal philosophy, they have got Jnana Unmukhi Sukriti accumulated for many lives. They may have a little Bhakti Unmukhi Sukriti also mixed up, like this devotee I was mentioning earlier. But the Bhakti Unmukhi Sukriti was obviously more powerful, therefore he became a devotee and he stayed a devotee and is still a devotee. But that Jnana Unmukhi Sukriti was still causing some agitation. So he must have associated with both in previous lives.
But ultimately it is a harmful
thing. It is harmful, yes. So we associate with so many things and so many people, therefore we have to be very cautious. Therefore Mahaprabhu has cautioned us that we should be very careful, that we should not hear philosophy that leads us to believe that God is not a person, that God doesn't have a form.
Trying to attain me by the impersonal knowledge, they also ultimately come to me.
The question is that Krishna says in the 8th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita that even those who worship the impersonal come to me, yes, but that is Krishna as his in his impersonal form. We do not say that the impersonal does not exist, but the impersonal is an aspect of Krishna, of the Absolute Truth. It is his bodily effulgence. Just like there is a sun and the sunshine. So the impersonal is like the sunshine. So we do not deny the impersonal. But we certainly deny the fact that merging into the impersonal existence is not something we want. Because there is no possibility of service in the impersonal absolute. It's only existence. So because the impersonal is also an aspect of his own existence, those who merge into the impersonal are also with Krishna, but not with the person Krishna, not with Bhagavan, not in the spiritual planets, but they merged into his impersonal effulgence. Somebody else had a hand raised somewhere? Yes. The question is that Prabhupada said in one lecture that our real devotional service starts when we realize we are not this body. Probably the verse you are referring to is from the 18th chapter. Does anyone know which verse? Yes. Brahma Bhuta Prasannatma Na Shochati Na Kankshati Samah Sarveshu Bhuteshu Mad Bhaktim Labhate Param. The meaning of this verse is that when one achieves the Brahma-bhuta platform, the Brahma-bhuta platform is the state of consciousness when one understands and realizes that one is not the body, one is the soul. Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman, I am spirit soul, I am not the body. At that time, one becomes free from lamentation and hankering. One also sees all living beings equally. And at that time, Krishna says, Mat bhaktim labhate param. One obtains, labhate, Bhakti, what is the nature of that bhakti? Parabhakti, pure bhakti. Why is that? So long as the bodily conception of life is there, our bhakti is mixed. In the bodily conception of life, we have some separate interest from serving Krishna. It's not anyapilashita shunya. We have some other interest apart from Krishna's interest. But when we are free from the bodily conception of life and we render service to Krishna, then that service to Krishna is now on the pure spiritual platform. Therefore, it's pure bhakti, para bhakti. So that's the meaning of that statement. Yes.
You know, you said bhakti yoga is the answer, and complete surrender is the way to do it. But let's say, for example, I'm from a different country or even a different planet, and I don't know about Krishna. I've come here for the first time, and I've heard you say that surrender yourself completely to Krishna. But to me, how can I surrender myself completely to Krishna when my rational mind is asking me, what's the proof?
So the question is, why should you surrender to Krishna?
Yeah, why should I surrender? I mean, it's easy for me to, suppose somebody has helped me someday, sacrificing everything in the process of helping me, it's easy for me to surrender to him. But how, I find it,
yes.
How do I start?
So therefore, when we want to know about why we should surrender to Krishna, then we have to read Krishna's explanation in the Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita gives us a whole explanation of what the nature of this material world is, what our nature is, what our condition and position in this world is, what exactly our problem is, and what the solution is. So the complete analysis is given in the Bhagavad Gita. So if we read, then we come to know what is what. Because Krishna is God, we are part and parcel of Him. Our natural position with respect to Krishna